WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the days and weeks following the terrorist attacks of 9/11, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was a constant presence on our TV screens as the star of countless press briefings in the ramp-up to the war in Afghanistan. The Pentagon Press Corps appreciated his wry humor, his haiku-like obfuscations. He was considered hot property by the public. He even had an online fan club. His image was burnished further as he led us by the hand through the invasion of Iraq. But the allegations of Iraqi prisoner abuse seem to have changed all that for Rummy.
On Wednesday, in a stunning about-face for an administration known for closing ranks, President Bush allowed his scolding of Donald Rumsfeld to be leaked to the press. Then followed a deluge of calls from the media and the public for Rumsfeld to resign, from The Economist magazine to The New York Times to an outburst at a hearing on Friday before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
I have a few additional words.
What about the other abuses in Iraq? What about the collective punishment?
The heckler's calls were heard in the Arab world as the hearing was broadcast live on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. As Rumsfeld faced a rising tide of anger at home, President Bush expressed his own outrage on Arab TV over the prisoner abuse, without actually taking responsibility for it.
It's also important for the people of Iraq to know that in a democracy, everything is not perfect, that mistakes are made.
Knight Ridder reporter Hannah Alam is in Baghdad, and she watched last Wednesday as the president went on Arab TV. Hannah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
This week, President Bush went on Al Arabiya and the U.S.-funded Al Khura in an attempt at damage control over the pictures that have emerged from the Abu Ghraib prison. First, what was the effect of those images among the Iraqi public, and then how did the president's interview play on the networks there?
The photos were played pretty much ad nauseum on all Arabic language stations, and people were shocked, disgusted. They said things like, is this democracy? Is this the fulfillment of promises from the coalition? It's the talk of coffee shops and definitely inside homes, especially the homes of the families of detainees who for months now have been contacting attorneys and human rights groups about just this kind of alleged abuse. Certainly, these allegations were familiar to them under the old regime, but I don't think they expected them from a coalition who was coming into Iraq as their liberator. I was watching newscasts Thursday, and the second wave of apparent prisoner abuse photos played very big on newscasts. You can see them every hour, along with the president's condemnation of the abuse at Abu Ghraib.
Is anyone saying, well, good for you, Mr. President, that's exactly what we wanted to hear?
No, I think the general feeling is that this condemnation, which really stopped short of an apology, was too little too late. I don't know that there's anything that anyone from the U.S. administration could do right now to lessen the outrage Iraqis are expressing to me and other journalists.
What have you been seeing on Al Hurra or Al Iraqiya, the two U.S.-funded stations there? Has the United States had any success in getting out its own message?
I really haven't watched Al Hurra or Iraqiya very much, simply because as a journalist, I don't find it very useful. Most of the broadcasts are taken up with gardening shows, home improvement programs, and other light fare for the viewers. There are something like 40 minutes of news allowed each day. And most Iraqis that I've interviewed have told me they'd turn to the pan-Arab stations, Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera in particular, for news of what's really going on in Iraq.
Well, there are no Nielsen ratings in Iraq, no people meters, but a USA Today CNN Gallup poll in late March and early April found that 74% of people in Iraq are watching Al Arabiya, and that the next most watched channel was Al Arabiya with 28% and Al Jazeera with 27%. Do those numbers sound even remotely correct to you?
Certainly people who can't afford satellite television, who can receive Iraqiya, will watch it simply because it's on. I would definitely say that most people I've interviewed prefer what they consider the more independent pan-Arab stations.
There's clearly a lot of frustration on the part of the State Department and the Pentagon that these tools of free expression that, from their perspective, they brought to Iraq are being used in the PR war and in many ways the actual insurgency against U.S. troops. This nightmare of unintended PR consequences, after all, is a primary gift of democracy, no?
That's right. And many Iraqis have said, at least we can choose now what we want to watch. We can watch Al Hurra if we want. We can watch Arabiya. We can watch CNN. They're still thrilled over the fact that they can go out and buy a satellite. And Iraqis are definitely appreciative of this new technology that was banned under Saddam Hussein. At the same time, they're not appreciative of the images they're seeing.
Hannah, thank you.
Thanks very much. Take care.
Hannah Alam is the Baghdad bureau chief for the Knight Ridder newspapers.
When the U.S. government put up its newly hatched Iraqi media network proposal for bid last year, it chose a radio and TV equipment company called Harris Corp, which teamed up with the Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation to run the network. It did not choose veteran journalist Stephen Schwartz, much to his chagrin. Schwartz, author of The Two Faces of Islam and a regular contributor to the conservative Weekly Standard, had spent time in Bosnia as a reporter and representative of the United Federation of Journalists, and later in Kosovo as a reporter and an advisor to the Kosovo Association of Journalists. He says that what happened in Bosnia offers an object lesson in how not to launch a free and independent media. And he says we're making the same mistakes in Iraq. Stephen Schwartz, welcome to the show.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Now, you worked on the creation of the new media in Bosnia following that war with Simon Hayslock, a Brit who has since been drafted by the United States to help recreate Iraqi media. Now, last summer you wrote that he's making the same mistakes in Iraq that he previously made in Bosnia.
Oh, yes. You know, I like Simon very much because even though Simon made a terrible mess in Bosnia, Simon was compelled to actually do the right thing in Kosovo. There was a big difference, and I can very quickly explain the difference. In Bosnia, what you had was ex-communist bureaucracy media left over from the Tito regime. The foreigners had this attitude, which I think also they have in Iraq, that the Bosnians were not responsible, that the Bosnians didn't know how to do media. And they came in with the attitude that they had to set up a bureaucracy that would administer the Bosnian media. That effort failed. The bureaucracy didn't work. The Bosnian media fell back into all of the bad habits of the old communist regime. It became ideological media. In Kosovo, it was different because Milosevic had done the Albanians an unintentional favor by shutting down their language media. The Albanian journalists had all gone to the West and had learned how to be Western-style, modern, independent, responsible journalists. And in Kosovo, you had a situation a lot like Iraq. You had a big upsurge of media.
They had a huge Albanian diaspora to help support media when it finally got relaunched.
This is a very important point. The Bosnian media became dependent upon foreign funding. In Kosovo, there was a large diaspora, and the Albanian media was not dependent on foreign funding.
And in Iraq?
In Iraq, there's no reason that the Iraqi media should be dependent on foreign funding. A country that can produce 100 to 200 newspapers and magazines after the fall of the dictatorship is a country that's full of resources and full of entrepreneurship and full of the will to create a media. What I'm saying is that they should do in Iraq what they were compelled to do in Kosovo, which is essentially just leave the media alone. Let the journalists be journalists. There is a place for foreign experts as mentors, as teachers, as advisors. But the project will only work in Iraq if the Iraqis can develop free institutions. It's not for us to give.
So the big story about the Iraqi media this week is the walkout by the editor and much of the staff of Al Sabah. That's the newspaper run by the U.S.-funded Iraqi Media Network. Now, before the editor and the staff walked out, it published a detailed critique of the media laws that are set to be imposed in Iraq. In particular, they mentioned Coalition Decree No. 65.
Well, Decree No. 65, which is a classic Simon Hayslock-type decree, basically gives the coalition and its successor, the government of Iraq, regulatory control over print media, broadcasting, coverage of elections, mobile telephone services, internet providers, and internet cafes. This is from Al-Sabah's editorial. Quote, "This commission will be lawmaker, prosecutor, and judge. In order to be prosecutor and judge, this commission will need considerable staff to monitor television and radio programs and read the newspapers and weeklies," unquote. This means that this Communications and Media Commission will be a state within the state, bigger than Saddam's Ministry of Information. And to be perfectly blunt, this is a Middle Eastern country where government ministries are magnets for corruption.
Stephen, I can see everything that's wrong with this commission, but you say that the alternative is that Iraq should have laws like ours that say First Amendment expression should only be curbed in cases of direct incitement of violence and libel. But we're talking about a country in the midst of chaos, a country that is at war not just with the coalition, but with itself in many cases. When you have a newspaper that cites so-called eyewitnesses that say American helicopters fired missiles into a UN compound when it was demonstrably not the case, don't you think that somebody needs to step in and say, this is wrong, you can't say things like that? Or is that the price of freedom?
You know, when we look back at the history of our own country, when the First Amendment was promulgated in the United States, this was a pretty chaotic country. We had come out of the Revolution. There were rebellions. There were Indian wars. Slave rebellions had begun. There have been many examples of countries that have had civil conflicts that have not surrendered the freedom of the press. I think that it's better to have a free press that says some irresponsible things and to have them out in the open, because in fighting against the extremists in Iraq, we need to know what the extremists are thinking and saying. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we can't have complete media freedom in Iraq today. But my view is we should at least start from the position, as journalists, we must start from the position of advocating for the maximum possible freedom, rather than starting from the position of assuming the maximum possible control.
But I guess that depends on what the coalition really wants. Do they want a flourishing media, or do they want better public relations for the United States?
You're right. They have to choose. They have to decide what it is they want to do. And I think they should decide in favor of helping Iraq develop a flourishing independent media, even if that media is critical of the United States and the coalition. Paul Wolfowitz has put it this way, and I agree with him. If we really believe that we're doing this to create democracy, then we have to accept the consequences if the people in that democracy get angry at us.
All right. Stephen Schwartz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Schwartz is the author of The Two Faces of Islam and frequent contributor to The Weekly Standard.
Coming up, the media seem in a hurry to bury candidate Kerry. One image advisor says he should be appealing to our inner crocodile.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The humiliation practiced upon prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison is documented in a detailed Pentagon report by Major General Antonio M. Taguba. That report, now available in its entirety on such websites as globalsecurity.org and MSNBC.com, has informed several recent media accounts, most notably one by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker magazine. Meanwhile, as of Tuesday, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said he had not, as yet, read all the way through it. It seems odd that he lags behind reporters. He had a running start, since the document was classified secret, a fact that troubled at least one Pentagon reporter at a Tuesday press conference. He put the question to General Peter Pace, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Was this kept secret because of it would be embarrassing to the world, particularly the Arab world?
First of all, I do not know specifically why it was labeled secret. Potentially there are parts of the hundreds and hundreds of pages of documentation that are classified. I do not know that to be a fact, but normally
the general didn't know exactly why it was classified, so the reporter tossed the ball to Rumsfeld.
Secretary, can you say why it was classified secret? Do you know?
No, you'd have to ask the classifier.
Stephen Aftergood is the director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy, and he's not satisfied with that answer. He joins me now. Welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you.
So as you read through the now infamous report, as have many concerned citizens, excepting, I guess, those up the chain of command at the Pentagon, what point did it dawn on you that the document had probably been improperly classified?
Well, when you focus on the paragraphs that are marked as secret, what you see very quickly is that these are not conventional national security secrets. They're not the design details of advanced military technologies or the names of confidential sources. What they are descriptions of criminal acts of torture. And that kind of information is not what the National Security Classification System was intended to protect.
There is absolutely nothing in that document that could endanger American lives or American operations in Iraq?
It is not evident. I think one could maybe stretch a little and make an argument that disclosure of this information could interfere with U.S. relations with foreign nations, as indeed it has done. But it is not national security information of the kind that we normally think of as classified.
But in your view, it was wrongly classified secret, not just because of what it doesn't contain, but also because of what it does contain.
That's right. There's a specific provision in the executive order on classification which states, in no case shall information be classified in order to conceal violations of law, inefficiency, or administrative error, or to prevent embarrassment to a person, organization, or agency. End of quote. But if you look at the paragraphs of the Taguba report that are marked as secret, in many cases, they are itemizations of specific crimes that were committed. In other words, they're precisely the kind of thing that the executive order on classification says shall in no case be classified.
Now, obviously, classification keeps things out of the public eye, and if this report and the pictures hadn't been leaked, we wouldn't know about it at all.
That's right, and as far as anyone knows, the report itself remains classified today. The fact that we have it in our hands is only thanks to what is formally, at least, an unauthorized disclosure of classified information, or a leak. I think it underscores the essential role that leaks can play. Leaks help correct excessive secrecy.
It's often been noted that this administration is making many more secrets now than previous administrations, and even more each year.
That's right. According to the latest annual report from a government agency called the Information Security Oversight Office, the number of new classification decisions in the last year grew 25% over that of the preceding year. It was up from 11 million new secrets to 14 million new secrets. That's a lot of secrecy going on.
Do you think that the classification of the Taguba report was simply the result then of an overzealous classifier?
If I had to guess, I would say it's the error of a classifier who didn't give the matter too much thought, recognized that the subject is sensitive, and just reflexively decided to classify it. But I think it's a questionable enough decision that it requires further investigation. And in fact, last week we turned to the Information Security Oversight Office, which has oversight over classification policy, and ask them to conduct an investigation into this very question. And the early indications are that they will do so to try to get to the bottom of it.
If the classification were, in fact, a clear violation of federal policy, could you or any other interested party actually sue the government? Are there such suits, and are they successful?
You know, it is possible to sue the government under the Freedom of Information Act, for example, and to argue that the information that has been withheld is improperly classified. That kind of lawsuit is rarely, if ever, successful. In terms of holding the government accountable, that is something that is probably best done not through litigation, but through congressional oversight and ultimately through elections.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Aftergood is the director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy. He spoke to us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C.
This is from the front page of the New York Times. Quote, "The Democrats are in serious trouble. Although Bush's approval ratings are low, the presumptive Democratic nominee can't get any traction. His campaign continues to confront a cloud of doubts and reservations, and voters are complaining that he hasn't offered the country a clear vision for the future." That passage comes courtesy of Tim Grieve, senior writer for Salon, who used it in his story about the John Kerry campaign. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, the Times quote was pretty alarming for the Democratic candidate. So what's the catch?
The catch is the Times quote comes from 1992 when Bill Clinton was the Democratic candidate. Sounds a lot like what the Times said this week about John Kerry, too, though.
Clinton, I believe, went on to beat President George H.W. Bush. So what is the matter with the whole lot of us that we can only accentuate the negative and not look at, for example, Clinton's experience to see hope for even a struggling John Kerry?
I think the problem that the media has so far in this campaign is this effort at every point to take things in an equal way. The Vietnam service question, for example, has been a constant presence in this campaign. It should be a sure winner for Kerry. Maybe it's Kerry's fault that it isn't a sure winner, but you also get things like U.S. News and World Report last week running a cover story that shows Bush and Kerry on the front of the cover with a headline that says 1971 was a defining moment for each of them.
The cover shows a gung-ho-looking President Bush in uniform reporting to duty precisely where we don't know, and a disheveled-looking John Kerry with an enormously bad haircut.
That's right. Kerry's hairstyle in 1971 hasn't held up quite as well as Bush has had. But the point is well taken that you've got Kerry there in a suit. You've got Bush there in a military uniform as if this is a close call or the tie goes to Bush. And in this case, if Bush can make this Vietnam issue something like a tie, geez, what a huge victory for him.
If the negativity and naysaying is premature or just plain wrong, is there any reason to think that it will actually have an effect on the electorate?
That's the big question. Does this become a self-fulfilling prophecy? And it didn't with Clinton. It did to some degree with Gore. And the question now is what happens with John Kerry? One of the things that the press does wrong is it focuses so exclusively on these national poll numbers. National voting does not determine elections. And if you need proof of that, you can ask President Al Gore. The media really needs to start looking at the polling in individual swing states. If things change in those states, that makes a huge difference.
All right. Now, Tim, it's clear that you believe that the declarations of disaster are premature, but you're not suggesting that the guy is doing a great job, are you?
Look, John Kerry came from a place right at the end of the primaries where he was relatively unknown, had very little money, and was not a choice that a lot of Democrats made enthusiastically. Bush has spent nearly $60 million on advertising. He has all the advantages of the incumbency. And as of this week, the race is still even. Given the dynamic of this race, I don't think John Kerry ought to be unhappy with where he is.
Do you think this is just glibness on the part of the media that just don't have enough to do with 6 months to go before Election Day, that they're just looking for details to pick at?
I think there are holes in weeks where there are stories that need to be written, and this was a storyline that made sense last week. There are also Democrats out there who are expressing these kinds of concerns about Kerry, who think, you know, he should be more energetic, who think he should be Howard Dean, and they provide just enough of a hook for these stories to get written.
But if Democrats are in fact out there panicking, either on the record or off, aren't the media doing exactly what they're supposed to do by informing the public of unease in inner Democratic circles?
Sure. It's perfectly reasonable for the media to inform the public of the unease. It just gets a little overblown when you have stories on the front page in the New York Times talking about Democrats being scared and Kerry struggling to find a theme when Kerry is, in fact, in an extremely close race with the President of the United States.
All right. Well, Tim, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Tim Grieve is a senior writer for Salon.com. The magazine is based in San Francisco. He spoke to us from Sacramento.
John Kerry may well be on course, but it's never too early to sharpen a candidate's image. And so we learned that earlier this year, medical anthropologist and marketing consultant Clotaire Rapaille sat down with an unpaid Kerry advisor to talk shop. Rapaille is originally from France, so he may seem an odd choice to advise a candidate maligned for his Gallic family ties. But some of the Fortune 500's biggest companies have tapped Rapaille for tips on how to appeal to American consumers. We spoke to him last about GM's ad campaign for the Hummer. Rapaille bases his approach on the theory of the triune brain, which postulates that our minds work on three levels. They are, in order of evolutionary development, the reptilian, responsible for basic survival behaviors like fight or flight, the limbic, which governs our emotions, and the neocortex, control center for language and rational thinking.
the one that always wins is the reptilian brain. So, you know, every candidate is interested in trying to connect with the collective reptilian brain.
This is the part of the brain that isn't beset by ethical considerations.
The reptilian is very much into survival, instinct, reproduction. But you see, I was born and raised in Europe, and I choose to become an American. But there are two different ways of thinking. The European way is always everything is subtle. There are a lot of nuance. The gray color is everywhere. We're not sure of this. We're not sure of that. And we try this. And okay, the reptilian brain is different. At the reptilian, you're not a little bit pregnant. You are pregnant or you're not pregnant. You're not a little bit dead. You're either dead or not dead. And some people, when we live in a world of a lot of confusion, they want to be reassured. They want to be reconnected with the reptilian. Senator Kerry might be a very intelligent guy, and I'm sure he is, very full of nuance and understanding all the different subtlety of everything. I'm not sure this is what Americans need right now.
So what would you tell Kerry to do?
Buy a ranch.
Buy a ranch, okay.
A pickup truck, I put a gun on the back and a six-pack beer and go speak with real people in Middle West.
But the suggestions you just had for Kerry to improve his image with the American voters is to turn himself into George W. Bush. I mean, right now the country is divided almost exactly in half. Why should he turn into Bush?
No, I don't want him to turn into Bush. I think that both candidates should be connected with the reptilian. And right now, maybe Bush is more reptilian because he is less cortex. And this is clear.
All right.
But Americans don't like intellectuals. We're afraid of intellectual people. To think too much is dangerous. We want people to have the gut feeling about what I need. If I had the possibility to give an advice to Senator Kerry, I would say he has to really learn to give simple answers to simple questions. He has to stick with one or two words, not 25, not 35, because you lose people very quickly.
The New Yorker recently observed that Kerry has suddenly stopped speaking to French reporters in their native language. Is he merely shedding his associations with France here, or does the fact that he's no longer speaking French suggest that being educated is somehow a turnoff?
For some people, absolutely. You know, I want my mother to have a gut feeling about when she's going to take me to the hospital or not. It doesn't matter how many books she read. You know, it's okay when you're a good reptilian person. Then you have the limbic and the cortex is fine. But when you are cortex and there is a risk that you are only cortex, that's what people really resent.
So we're on to something here. Clinton appealed both to the reptilian and to the cortex.
Absolutely. I mean, it was always reptilian. His saga, his story was fantastic. Always a girl under the table. He was a genius in providing material to all the comedians of the nation.
Is packaging a candidate to sell to the American people the same as, say, packaging the Hummer? Are you going for the same basic thing?
Well, knowing the power of a brand and the connection we have with these brands is powerful. A candidate is a brand, and a candidate should know what he stands for. For example, when you say Volvo, you say safety. This is one word, okay? When you say Kerry, what do you say? Kerry need to do a better job in defining who he is, because so far the Bush campaign is trying to labelize John Kerry as flip-flop. Well, this is not the good brand. It's like if a car maker was labeling his competitors rollover. And so immediately when you see a Range Rover, you say, oh, rollover, this car is not safe.
If the candidates, now I'm going to sound a little like Barbara Walters, but if you would assign car makes to candidates, would Bush be the Hummer?
Yes.
And what would Kerry be?
Hybrid.
Clotera Pai, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Clotera Pai is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Archetyping the Presidency, which hits store shelves this summer.
And now for a few of your letters. Shannon Thomas of Marina Del Rey, California, wrote in with this comment on our interview with Washington Post columnist David Ignatius. I could not believe his self-serving and arrogant interpretation of the media's failures in covering the run-up to the war in Iraq, that they were, quote, victims of their own professionalism. The idea that the American media is so objective as to never have a hand in creating the news is preposterous. If a news organization feels it must get the word out, there is much they can do.
Hugh Sansom of Brooklyn, New York, wrote in to say that my interview with Coalition Provisional Authority spokesman Robert Tappan last week was neither fair nor balanced. Writes Sansom, what's most striking about the general American hysteria over Arabs reporting from their own perspective is the sheer hypocrisy. Sansom adds that if we examine Tappan's charges generically, they are a, quote, far better description of American journalism than Al Jazeera.
Daniel Lozel of New York City, a Vietnam-era veteran, had this response to our discussion of Nightline's decision to devote an entire program to the names of American service people who have died in Iraq. He writes, anyone who can't handle hearing the names of those who died in combat has no business supporting the war, period. Those who would paint the identification and remembrance of our war dead as a partisan political maneuver should be brought to the light of day and forced to experience the true horror of war themselves.
Thanks for your letters. Send them to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, do-it-yourself censorship has Hollywood up in arms and a movie icon who has endured for 50 years without uttering a word.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week at Walmart, a DVD player with a sense of morality. Bill Bennett's sense of morality, to be precise. Using technology developed by a company called ClearPlay, the new RCA DVD player can automatically skip past scenes of nudity, violence, even drug use, and mute bad language. Or if, say, you like violence but find nudity distasteful, you can filter out whatever permutations of perversity suit you and your family best.
Not so fast, says the Directors Guild of America, which has brought suit, claiming that the ClearPlay technology illegally alters a copyrighted work of art without permission of the artist. Last week, Republican House Judiciary Committee Chairman James Sensenbrenner directed the committee's copyright panel to investigate, and there may be hearings on the matter before the month is out. Given the already overheated debate over indecency, we can only imagine what's in store. Back in 2002, when the ClearPlay technology was available only as computer software, several DGA members, including Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese, brought a copyright infringement suit. That's when we called Martha Coolidge, a director herself and then president of the Directors Guild.
It's great to be here.
Now, defenders of the technology that we're talking about here liken it to getting some good advice from someone who's screened the movie before you and can tell you when to block the screen and what to skip. Would you be against it if it weren't actually technology, but just a list of instructions blocking some scenes because of nudity and skipping certain scenes or even individual frames to excise bad language or blasphemies?
But, Brooke, wouldn't you have a problem if someone was listening to your program and gave instructions as to how to fast-forward to skip over the part that you'd spent the entire interview working up to? What you're talking about is someone else who did not make the movie, who does not know the material as intimately as the filmmakers and the copyright holders do, making arbitrary decisions as to what they do and do not like for the viewer. The viewer never sees the material.
There's always going to be a disparity between what the directors intend to give the audience and how the audience uses the films that are given to them. It seems as if you're trying to control the uncontrollable, how your films are perceived or even used.
I think that it has to do with your creation and your property. We are a country based on protection of property. Directors make thousands and thousands and thousands of decisions regarding every aspect of a movie. And the idea that certain movies are simply inappropriate for certain age groups or certain people is accurate. Steven Spielberg made E.T. That is appropriate for children. And he made Saving Private Ryan, which he said was not. The whole point of the movie was to be groundbreaking in its gritty depiction of war and reality. And the idea of someone else taking that movie, not Steven Spielberg, someone else taking that movie and chopping it up so that it's appropriate for children when it was never, never, never intended for children. And frankly, in my opinion, no matter how much you take out of the movie, the subject matter is not appropriate for children.
What we're talking about here is technology that gives people greater choice in tailoring entertainment. And that is what entertainment is tending toward. And one benefit that you can presumably draw from all of this is that the people who wouldn't want to see a movie with a nude scene in it would go and see it if they had the opportunity to blank that nude scene out. Does the potential for a larger audience give you any satisfaction?
Well, Brooke, you can look at it the other way. Imagine how many movies would have an increased audience if you put nude scenes in. And would you defend that, too? Would you think that nude scenes could be provided on this nude technology, which can provide it? It can dress Kate Winslet in the Titanic. Believe me, it can undress people in other movies. It is still an arbitrary decision made by someone based on what they believe. There are senseless alterations. There's the lightsaber version of Princess Bride. Whom does that benefit? Who was offended by the swords? Is this not just the simple fact that it can be done, therefore let's do it?
Well, Martha Coolidge, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for dealing with the issue.
Martha Coolidge is a film and television director. She was the president of the Directors Guild of America from 2002 to 2003.
One film that would likely make it unscathed through a ClearPlay DVD player is Godzilla. The King of the Monsters turns 50 this year, and to commemorate the Great Lizard's golden anniversary, a restored print of the original Japanese version has been stomping through selected theaters across the country. Finally, American audiences can view the cut that director Ishiro Honda intended. There's 40 minutes of unseen footage, subtitles to replace the cheesy dubbing, and no Raymond Burr. He was added for the comfort of stateside audiences. Many critics are saying the original is far less campy and far more genuinely haunting. The same cannot be said for the sequels, now numbering nearly 30 and counting. NPR's Jim Zaroli looks back on a half century of Godzillas.
Even before you saw Godzilla, you heard his footsteps falling on the earth ominously, shaking buildings and trees. Soon he would appear in the water or over the crest of a hill, an enormous scaly creature like a dinosaur with a roar that was somewhere between a lion and a giant vacuum cleaner. He had a stiff, lumbering gait and a tail that could squash skyscrapers. He emitted a kind of radioactive beam that he could train on his enemies. He was always getting tangled up in power lines. And when he showed up, whole villages fled in terror. Godzilla was not like American movie monsters. He didn't lurk in the shadows waiting to pounce. He wasn't malevolent. He was a kind of huge, unstoppable force that showed up unexpectedly and, almost despite himself, left a trail of destruction in his wake. And if you grew up in this country in the 60s and 70s, you probably watched his movies after school, usually on the low-rent UHF stations. For fans like John Lippertito and Norman England, there was nothing like Godzilla.
When you're a kid, you're a boy, everyone's telling you what to do and everyone can put you down. And then you look at Godzilla and nobody can put this guy down. And he walks around, does what he wants to do, he knocks some buildings over. And just as a boy, I don't know, I felt like, oh, wow, that would be cool if I could do that kind of thing.
I think kids kind of want to be Godzilla, so I think he's a natural child icon.
He's a role model.
In truth, there was never one Godzilla any more than there was one Cinderella or Robin Hood. The first Godzilla movie was a dark, serious story about a monster who was somehow brought to life after nuclear tests in the Pacific. He rampages Tokyo before being killed. As this dubbed American version suggests, the shadow of Hiroshima hangs over the movie.
At 3:30 this morning, a ship from Tokyo was literally wiped from the surface of the ocean in a matter of seconds.
Anything from the ship's radio?
It said there was a blinding flash of light, and the ocean burst into flame.
The first Godzilla was no B-movie. It was the most expensive film ever made in Japan at the time, and its cast and crew included some of Japan's most talented people, including some who worked regularly with Akira Kurosawa. The huge success of Godzilla led to sequels. Godzilla took on new monsters like the gentle Mothra and the three-headed Ghidorah in long, epic clashes that were like battles between gods. To many fans, it was the golden age of Godzilla. But by the late 60s, says film historian David Callett, Godzilla, like the Terminator later on, had changed, going from marauding menace to superhero. This Godzilla saved cities from other monsters.
Partly it was a reflection of the fact that Godzilla was obviously the popular character, and that's the key around which the franchise was revolving. So if you're going to keep bringing back the character over and over and over again, and the audience is going to be there to watch him do his stuff, naturally that audience sympathy works better if you're depicting him as a heroic character rather than a villain.
By the 1970s, monster movies were no longer very profitable, and Godzilla's producer, Toho Studios, started cutting the series' budget.
Godzilla! And Kamakura!
Toho also began aiming Godzilla at children, and the stories became more simplistic, even campy. Callett says one reason so many Americans think of Godzilla movies as crudely made is because they grew up watching the Godzilla of that period.
I've often had the pleasure of taking somebody who has that negative opinion and showing them an earlier film like Godzilla vs. Mothra and watching their eyes open as they go, wow, this is really good.
In the 1980s, Godzilla fans mounted a successful letter-writing campaign to persuade Toho to return to the darker, more serious movies of the past. Since then, Toho has been churning out new movies of varying quality every few years. The most recent movies are, by contemporary standards, pretty low-tech. Godzilla is still played by a man in a rubber suit who tromps through miniature cities. And that is fine with fans. For people like Norman England, part of the appeal of the old Godzilla movies was that they didn't look realistic.
Today there's kind of a more of an emphasis in both Japanese films and American films on looking real. And what I really liked about in the 60s was it didn't necessarily look real. It looked like another world. And the miniatures themselves kind of hold an appeal like a very intricately designed HO scale train set. So as a boy, I mean, I just would just watch these films with my mouth hanging down.
Trying to put Godzilla in the real world, fans say, somehow detracts from his power, making him just another movie monster. A few years ago, Columbia TriStar released an American version of Godzilla starring Matthew Broderick. It had all the special effects money could buy. Godzilla tramped through the streets of Manhattan looking realer and scarier than ever before.
God, come on, let's go.
One second, this is unbelievable.
The movie was a box office disappointment, and many Godzilla fans in particular loathed it. Still, Toho has continued putting out Godzilla movies in Japan, and Godzilla remains one of the few Japanese entertainment exports that's instantly recognizable around the world. A few years ago, when the 6'2" Osaka-born Hideo Nomo went to pitch for the Los Angeles Dodgers, he was nicknamed Godzilla, and no one had to explain the reference. After nearly half a century of doing battles against monsters of all kinds, Godzilla continues to triumph, at least as a cultural icon. For On the Media, this is Jim Zeroli.
In 1916, an 18-page short story titled Lolita, about an older man obsessed with a young girl, was published in a German short story collection. The author was Heinz von Lichtenberg. In 1958, Vladimir Nabokov's 300-page novel Lolita, also about an older man obsessed with a young girl, was published in the United States. Was Nabokov a plagiarist? Or as New York Observer columnist Ron Rosenbaum posed in a recent column, did Nabokov suffer from kryptonesia?
Well, I didn't invent the term kryptonesia to apply to this particular case. It was a German professor, Michael Marr, who was the one who actually discovered this 1916 story. And kryptonesia is sort of one of four possible ways to explain what Nabokov did. And the European press and a lot of Nabokovians are all in a tizzy because it's been played up as plagiarism. But it could be entirely coincident. Nabokov never read this story, although Professor Marr seems to have research that shows that Nabokov, in his exile from Russia, lived in the same section of Berlin as the German writer who wrote the Ur-Lolita, the 1916 Lolita, under the pseudonym von Lichtenberg. So it could be coincidence. It doesn't seem likely. So there are three other explanations. One is that Nabokov did sort of knowingly become inspired by reading von Lichtenberg's 1916 story, but never mentioned it, covered it up. Or explanation number three, this phrase, word, kryptonesia, which Webster defines as the appearance in consciousness of memory images which are not regarded as such, but which appear as original creations. In other words, one day Nabokov woke up and said, I want to do a story about an underage girl called Lolita and an older man who preys on her. He didn't realize that 10, 20, 30 years before he had read this German story, Lolita. It wasn't conscious.
But what do you think?
I can't make up my mind completely, but Marr does tell us that this guy von Lichtenberg later became a Nazi propagandist. Nabokov was quite anti-Nazi. In fact, his brother, who was gay, died in a Nazi concentration camp. So perhaps he did take his inspiration in some way, or at least the name Lolita, from von Lichtenberg's story. But he just wasn't going to give this guy the posthumous satisfaction of any credit. So that's a fourth possible explanation. But the kryptonesia one is really interesting because when I mentioned this to other writers or other writers who responded to this story, and the Observer said, you know, they, as am I, haunted by the idea that whenever you think of a phrase that you're really fond of and you put it in a story, I do at least wonder, oh, God, what if I read this phrase somewhere else by someone else and yet didn't consciously know it? And so I've left a lot of what I think are good phrases out of stories for fear of what I now know as kryptonesia.
You know, we've been discussing this literary application of kryptonesia, but I'm reminded of a musical one. Back in 1971, George Harrison was found guilty of infringing on the use of the melody from He's So Fine.
For My Sweet Lord, I know.
The judge didn't think he was consciously plagiarizing.
I thought he was found guilty and had to give the chiffons, was it, some...
Very good.
Some props and...
Yes, the judge didn't think he was consciously plagiarizing, and yet George Harrison was forced to pay the fine.
Yeah. You know, you wonder, like, would we be happier if George Harrison didn't do My Sweet Lord? Well, maybe, with that song. But nonetheless, you know, there are a lot of works of art that depend on other works of art. And a lot of literature is made up of scraps of other literature. And do we want to, like, be so purist-minded that we expect our artists to only utter things that have never been uttered before? What is new is more a way of phrasing what is old than an absolutely brand new thought about the nature of the universe.
Well, Ron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ron Rosenbaum wrote, New Lolita Scandal, Did Nabokov Suffer from Kryptonesia? For the New York Observer. And he also edited the forthcoming anthology, Those Who Forget the Past, The Question of Antisemitism. ¶¶
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen our engineer. We had help from Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.